had a good session studying the book of Exodus yesterday afternoon, and we're ready to go with to finish up. Our assignment for today is to finish up the historical chapters of Daniel. So we have basically four chapters to look at. We want to emphasize chapter 3 and chapter 5 because we have more information about them. We'll touch briefly on chapters 4 and 6. So let's review the image. The head of gold stands for what? Babylon. How do you know that? Thou, O king, art the head of gold. And we said that Nebuchadnezzar ruled for 43 years. He was a long-lived, long-reigning ruler. 43 years. Of the 70 years that the Neo-Babylonian kingdom lasted, he ruled for 43 of it. He was the great conqueror who extended the borders of Babylon all the way to the Mediterranean, all the way into Asia Minor, and to the borders of Egypt. So he was the great conqueror that built the empire. And in addition, he built the city of Babylon. In a little bit, I'm going to put a map of Babylon on the board for you, so you can get an idea where some of this action took place. But the old city of Babylon that goes back to about 2000 BC was a mile square. Nebuchadnezzar extended the city wall. He added a new city wall that was 7 miles long. And so he was the great builder. Now the tradition got garbled. And the tradition was that a queen named Semiramis was the one who built Babylon. That's not true. We know because right in the book of Daniel chapter 4, he's walking on the roof of the palace and he's looking out over the city and he says, "Is this not great Babylon which I have built?" And the bricks of Babylon testify to that. Because stamped in those bricks, thousands and thousands and thousands of those bricks had the royal insignia of Nebuchadnezzar stamped on them. And so the evidence of the bricks itself tells us who was the great builder of Babylon. And he was. So he built the empire, he built the capital city, and he ruled it the longest of any king of that dynasty. So when Daniel says, "You're the head of gold," Daniel has a perfectly appropriate historical setting in which to say that. But then he changes the word a little bit. He doesn't say, "Now the next king who's going to follow you." He says, "After you shall follow another," what? Kingdom, which will be inferior to yours. And so the Medes and the Persians come and conquer the city of Babylon. We're going to talk about that with Daniel chapter 5, because that transition took place right in the book of Daniel. So the change from the head of gold to the breast and arms of silver to the Medo-Persian Empire took place right within Daniel's own lifetime and right within the records of the book of Daniel. Now the third one is the belly and thighs of bronze, which represents Greece. We have the names of these kingdoms in chapter 8. Daniel 8 verse 20 gives us Medo-Persia. Daniel 8 verse 21 gives us Greece. So we have Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and then the last kingdom is not named. And so it simply takes a historical deduction to look at what happened to see that Rome was the one who followed and conquered mopped up, if you please, the Greek Empire. Alexander conquered the East and all the way to Egypt and all the way to the Indus River of India. And when the Roman Empire came along, they picked off the pieces of Alexander's empire little by little. They defeated Greece first in 168, then they conquered the city of Corinth in 146 and destroyed it. So that the city of Corinth that we know so well from the New Testament was in ruins for a century. And then it was rebuilt in the first century B.C. So when Paul came there, there was the rebuilt city. So that took care of Greece. And then Asia Minor had a king who did not have a male heir. And so he willed his kingdom. The kingdom of Pergamum was willed to Rome. 133 BC. Then the Roman general Pompey marched farther south into Syria, conquered Syria and Judea, and that was 60 BC, and I told the story in the afternoon class about how he went into the most holy place of the temple in Jerusalem because he wanted to see what the statue of the Israelite God looked like. But the room was empty, the most holy place. Remember, the Ark of the Covenant was hidden as the Babylonian troops were approaching, and apparently the knowledge of where it was hidden was lost, and so they did not replace it. All of the other equipment of the temple was replaced, but the Ark of the Covenant was not. And so Pompey walks in there to see the idol. There's no idol. It's an empty room. So that's Rome conquering Syria and Judea. And finally, Julius Caesar conquers Egypt. So those are the pieces of the Greek Empire that Alexander conquered, now conquered by Rome. So Rome is the kingdom which succeeds. So we have the names that you know so well: Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. And then finally, the question that I ended on yesterday was, what happened? Do we have another major world kingdom? Do we have two more, three more, four more? No. Does Rome stand forever? No, Rome did not stand forever. The barbarians knocking at the gates of Rome eventually destroyed the Roman Empire, and the Roman Empire broke up into pieces. And the pieces were first represented by the tribes, and then were represented by the modern nations which have developed from those tribes. But that's not the end of the story, is it? The glorious end of the story comes with the stone kingdom. And when the stone... You know, there was a man named Augustine, and he was a theologian of the 5th century A.D., and his contributions to theology were not very helpful. He wrote a book about the city of God and says the kingdom of God's right here in Rome, and he changed the teaching on the millennium. And he said that the millennium started with the cross. It's a teaching known as amillennialism. And he says this: if that were true, where would the stone have to strike? On the legs of iron. It doesn't strike the legs of iron. It strikes the feet of iron and clay after the divisions of Rome had taken place, because that's what we have in Europe today. And so the view of amillennialism that's held by some branches of Christendom is not the correct view. We believe in what is called premillennialism, that the millennium starts with the second coming of Christ and extends afterwards. So this is the image that we looked at, and that prophecy has a connection with the historical chapters that follow. It has a connection to chapter 3, and it has a connection to chapter 5. And for just a moment, I want to look ahead with you to chapter 5 and just see this interesting little connection. Because if you read the text carefully, you deserve a family prize like they give out in the preceding worship service. If you read it carefully, you'll see an interesting little hint. Now, Daniel chapter 5 is, of course, the story of the great banquet that Belshazzar has in the palace. In fact, he has the banquet in the night, the palace, when the city fell to the Medes and the Persians. And you'll notice what's going on during this banquet, verse 4, chapter 5, verse 4, Daniel. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Where have you seen those metals before? Daniel 2. All right. Now then, if you look down at verse 23, this is Daniel is brought in to help see if he can interpret the handwriting on the wall. And he chastises Belshazzar, and he says, "But you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before you." See, this is the blasphemy which he committed, the sacrilege. "And you and your nobles, your wives and your concubines have been drinking wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver, gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone." Did you catch it? What happened? They're reversed, aren't they? In the first list, gold starts the list just as gold starts the image. But when the list is given the second time by Daniel, he puts silver in front of gold, and the rest of the list is the same. It's a tiny little hint right in this chapter that Daniel is pointing you back to Daniel 2, showing you that the transition from the gold head to the silver breast and arms has taken place. It's going to take place right now, this night. We'll come back to that. But let's go to Daniel 3. So what is the connection between Daniel 2 and Daniel 3? Well, suppose for a moment that you're the king. You're Nebuchadnezzar. You're pleased with the fact that Daniel comes in and explains to you what the dream was that you had and what that dream meant. That's good. But wait a minute. There's some bad news in that vision. What's the bad news? There's going to be another kingdom after you. I don't want another kingdom after my kingdom. I want my kingdom to stand forever. So in Daniel chapter 3, he makes an image. And does he make the image like the image of Daniel 2? Does he put gold at the head and silver and then bronze and then iron? Is that the way he made the image? No, he didn't. 60 cubits or 90 feet high is this great image. It's probably, the interior is probably wood, and on the outside it has gold foil. But it has gold foil all the way up so that it looks like a gold image. One metal, and one metal only. I don't want a silver kingdom to follow mine. I want the gold kingdom to rule forever. You probably know that Hitler said that the Third Reich was going to last for 1,000 years. In actuality, it lasted for 5 years. So, you know, the proverb I gave yesterday afternoon in the other class is, man proposes, but God disposes. And that happened to Hitler, and it happened to Nebuchadnezzar. And it happened to Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. Now, I'd like to suggest another setting for Daniel chapter 3. I talked yesterday a little bit about the tablets from Nebuchadnezzar's reign, the first 13 years. And we learned a number of things about his reign. And one of the things we learned about his reign was there was a revolt against him. This was news, you know, because we had this picture, this magnificent world, all world encompassing, powerful ruler. Nobody could resist him or nobody could gain sway against him. But in actuality, there was a revolt against him. And the revolt was so serious that there was fighting in the palace. And Nebuchadnezzar himself was involved in hand-to-hand fighting in the palace to put down the revolt. And so read the record. This is for the year 595 B.C. In the 10th year, the king of Babylon was in his own land. This is Nebuchadnezzar. From the month of December to the month of Tebet, which is about February, there was rebellion in Akkad. With arms he slew many of his own army. His own hand captured his enemy. This was big news. We didn't know that prior to the discovery of these tablets, or the translation, decipherment of these tablets, we didn't know that there had been a revolt against Nebuchadnezzar. Now, let's put yourself in Nebuchadnezzar's place again. If there's a revolt against you, and some of the elements are from the army, and probably some of the elements from the palace, what would you do to correct that? Well, you want to make sure that everybody in government and the army are loyal to you, right? What do? Loyalty oath. Loyalty oath. So I want you to notice the first feature about Daniel chapter 3. Notice who is at the great congregation or the great assembly on the plain of Dura. And we have the list. It gives it twice, two or three times. And it says, then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then verse 3, it repeats the list over again. Then they all came. You know, gives the whole list. So they did. Nebuchadnezzar did not say, everybody in Babylon out on the plain. Everybody out. That is not what he said. He says, all of the officials of my government, every one of you, come to this, the dedication of this image. So it is not for the general population of Babylon, it's for the officials. And probably included within that would have been the army. And what does he have them do? The music plays, everybody bows down. They're pledging loyalty to the great image. There's some discussion about what the image is. And some have said that, well, it's maybe Nebuchadnezzar himself. More likely it was Marduk, which was his personal god and the god of the city of Babylon and the god of the country of Babylon. Because when we come to the Hebrew worthies, they say, we will not serve your gods. So it probably is a representation of the god. So it looks like, because of this revolt, he wants to have his officials pledge a loyalty oath. And so he gathers them all together. He has this great image made. Now the next point is, where is it? Well, it's on the plain of Dura. And where is the plain of Dura? Well, geographers, biblical geographers, have looked for a city named Dura and they have not found one. So somebody looked at the word again more carefully and said, hey, wait a minute. The word Dur, D-U-R, is the Babylonian word for wall. And the A at the end of the word is simply the article. In the Aramaic language, we put the article at the end of the word instead of the beginning of the word. So the plain of Dura really means the plain of the wall. That's a literal translation. And then somebody noticed, well, there's an ideal place in Babylon itself for this to take place. So let me give you a little map. You have to have a map to know where you're going. So here's the Euphrates River. The old city of Babylon that I mentioned before is 1 mile square, and it has 7 or 8 gates around it. The Great Ishtar Gate is located right here. And the palace is located here. And the temple is located here. And so, more so, this is the official buildings and homes and chapels and temples. There were 50 different temples in this city. But the main big temple was right at the bank of the Euphrates River. Nebuchadnezzar, as I mentioned, he was the great builder of this city. And so he built a new wall out here. So this wall is 1 mile square. And this wall is 7 miles long. Now, he didn't have time to fill in a lot of buildings here. But this space between the two walls was used by the Babylonian army. So when they came back from a campaign in the field, they would park their chariots out here and so forth. So this is the plain between the walls. Or, to put it another way, the plain of Dura. So we don't need to look for Dura in another city in Babylon someplace else. It's right here at Babylon. And so he makes the great image. And notice that in this temple area was the temple tower. And the temple tower looks like a pyramid. But it looks like a pyramid that's built up this way. And it had seven levels. And it had a walkway this way and a walkway this way. And these were made of colored bricks. It must have been very, very beautiful in its heyday. So if you think about the temple over here and the great image over here, the great image is looking at the temple tower. Now, the colors were, I don't remember their order, but red, green, blue, yellow, and so on and so forth. So they had enameled colored bricks that they put on the outside. But inside, it's sun-dried bricks. It's a solid, just a solid, it's an artificial mountain is what it is. And the only part used was this part up here, which is a temple. So this is the temple tower, and they had a word for that, and it's called a ziggurat.
Now this temple tower and the temple on top of this had a name. Very interesting name. I want you to think not about the book of Daniel, but about the book of Genesis. The name of this temple tower was the house or temple which lifts its head up to heaven. That's its name. And if you think about the story of the Tower of Babel, that was what they were trying to do in that construction. So the name used for this temple tower echoes what happened in Genesis. Well, now, so Nebuchadnezzar summons all of his officials. And the image is built here. It's 60 cubits high or 90 feet. And so critics have said, oh, you couldn't have anything. And also, but it's only 6 cubits wide at the base. And so critics have said, oh, you couldn't have that. That couldn't have been built. Well, on this recent trip I was on to visit the 7 churches in Asia Minor, we went to Patmos, and from Patmos you take a boat to the island of Rhodes. And on Rhodes there was the Colossus. And the Colossus of Rhodes was a statue which was a memorial for a victory, actually a defeat of the enemies who besieged the capital city of the island. And this Colossus of Rhodes was shaped in the form of a man, and it stood 100 feet high, 10 feet higher than Nebuchadnezzar's great image. Now, unfortunately, the Colossus is no longer there. It's gone. an earthquake that fell into the sea and so on and so forth. But we saw the spot where they think it used to stand. That was as close as you can get. That's about as close as you can get to Nebuchadnezzar's image, too. So, so the image is constructed. The people are assembled. And then we have an orchestra. The Babylonian Symphony Orchestra, the BSO. Yeah, I used to listen occasionally to the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Or the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. Which incidentally has a woman directing it now. So, the orchestra is assembled, and it's very interesting to see the list of the instruments used, because one of the instruments used in that orchestra was played here this morning. And the name for it in the biblical text is the kithara, which you know today as the guitar. And it migrated across North Africa from Morocco into Spain, and from Spain all over the world. So we have guitars here today, probably too many of them. So the kithara or guitar was one of the instruments in Nebuchadnezzar's orchestra. There are stringed instruments, 2 different types of harps, a large harp and a small harp, and there's wind instruments where they had something called a double flute. And then the last word is symphony, the last word in the list. And people have debated whether that means all of the instruments playing together or whether it's a name for another instrument. So linguists are still working with that list. Now, the interesting thing about that list is 3 of the words in the list are Greek. 3 Greek words. So critics of the book of Daniel say, well, the book of Daniel must have been written in the Greek period, not the Babylonian period. Well, if you look back at the list of the officials, which we just read, there's no Greek words in those lists. Remember, Daniel lived through the Babylonian period and into the Persian period. So he knew the names or titles for Babylonian officials, and he knew the titles for Persian officials. And that's what he uses in the list. But as I just mentioned about the story of the guitar, musical instruments can migrate. Cultural diffusion, it's called, as they are spread. And so probably these Greek instruments were brought by Greek traders or Greek mercenaries. The Greek mercenaries were also employed. Thank you. That will be helpful. It's nice and cold, too. All right, so we have the orchestra playing. And we have all the officials gathered. We have the image built. And as an additional emotional stimulus, they have a brick kiln over at one side fired up with a nice hot fire in case you didn't want to bow down. So there's quite a bit of pressure. Quite a bit of pressure on Daniel's three friends. And what do they do? Can you imagine? Picture the scene. 3,000 people. Have you seen these photographs of all the people at Mecca when they all bow down? That's what this scene must have looked like. The sea of people all bowing down. And here's three people still standing. And you must have looked like and felt like a sore thumb sticking out. Well, they, of course, are immediately reported to the king. And the king, of course, he's already angry, the way it describes it. And they come before him, and there's the interview between them and the king. And he gets madder. He's getting red in the face. Look, I just went through a rebellion. And here's three disloyal servants. These are just the kind of people that are going to start another rebellion against me. And so the king gets madder and madder and hotter and redder in the face. And you're standing isolated from everybody else on the plain of Dura. You're standing before the world's single most powerful human individual. What are you going to say? What would you say? Oh, I made a mistake. Let me go back and try it again. Let me take another shot at it. That's not what they said. This is a wonderful example of spiritual courage. And we should read it and revel in it, the courage that these young men... After all, these guys are about 21 years of age, maybe a little bit more, maybe they're up to 25 or 30. And so they reply to the king. Verse 16, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this. We do not hesitate to give you an answer. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. They have determined, on pain of death, that they are going to be firm to their faith, firm to their God, and they will not worship this idol image which has been set up, even if it costs them their lives. But they preface it by saying, our God can deliver us if he decides to. So Nebuchadnezzar says, away with them. So they are bound and they are taken to what probably looks a lot like an igloo. The brick kilns in Babylon look something like this. There were steps going up, and you would put a tray of bricks in here. And you would fire the bricks, and then the pallet of bricks would be brought out. So they probably were dropped down from above, if you please. And Nebuchadnezzar wants to make sure that the fire does a good job. So he comes over and he probably bows down here and looks in. And what he sees is four. And he says, well, wait a minute. Didn't we put three in? And now there's four. And he says, and I want to translate this exactly with you. And the fourth one looks like a son of the gods. That's an accurate translation of the Aramaic language here. You see, at this point, Nebuchadnezzar is not yet converted. In Daniel chapter 4, he's converted. But he's still a pagan polytheist.
But he can recognize the difference between an ordinary human being and a divine being. And that's what he's saying. He says the fourth one that I'm looking at looks like a divine being. There's a divine being in there with them. He doesn't know it's Christ. He doesn't know it's the Messiah standing beside them. But he can tell the difference between an ordinary human being and this divine being who's come to rescue them. And nothing has happened to them. Not the hair of their heads are singed, except the ropes that have fallen off their arms and legs into the fire. And so they are removed from the fire, and God has honored their courage and their fidelity to the truth of the Ten Commandments and the truth of the God they serve. Now that's a lesson for us. Because the book of Revelation, chapter 13, talks about a time when another image is going to be set up. Now here we have a literal image, a literal object. But the image in the book of Revelation, Revelation 13, is a symbolic image. Laws enacted by the state at the purpose of the church. And that is coming soon, to my understanding. And when it comes, the question is not whether it's going to come or not. The question is, what kind of a response are you going to give when it does come? When people say, when you go to the market and they say, sorry, you can't buy here anymore. You don't have such and such on your card. Sorry. When you can't buy or sell, and when you're threatened with a death decree. See, they were threatened with a death decree here. What kind of response are you going to give? They gave the right response. And may it be that each and every one here will give the same response. Our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, from your death decree, from your prohibition to buy and sell, whatever it is. Our God, whom we serve, can deliver us. He can feed us with ravens like he fed Elijah, if necessary. But if not, I'm still willing to die for him and not surrender. There's an interesting story about a woman who was imprisoned in a castle in France for a period of, I forget exactly how long, I think it was like 18 or 20 years. And she died there. And when they went in to remove her body, they found written on the wall, "Je résiste." I resist. And that's what these servants of Daniel did. And that's what we're supposed to do when the test comes. See, the test hasn't come yet. We live in a land of freedom. It's wonderful. You can worship here if you want. You can worship down the street if you want. You can worship in another denomination if you want. Religious freedom. One of these days, it's not going to be that free. And so the question is, what are you going to do? What's going to be your response when that comes, when that happens? May it be that each one here will give the same response as Daniel's friends did. I want to talk about Daniel 5 because it's a very interesting chapter to illustrate how accurate in history the book of Daniel is. See, there's a big argument about when the book of Daniel was written. Was it written in the 6th century B.C. when Daniel himself says it was? Or was it written in the 2nd century B.C. by an unknown author in Jerusalem who made up these stories or just used little kernels of truths and then expanded these into nice stories? You can test that theory, that hypothesis, by various bits of historical information in the book. And what those bits of historical information in the book show is that the book of Daniel, the author of the book of Daniel, knew the history of and experience of 6th century BC Babylon to an nth degree.
to an accurate degree that somebody in the second century could not have known. Now, I'm going to illustrate that in two ways, one in a general way and one in a specific way. The general way is, who's there? Who's the king in chapter 5? Belshazzar. But if you look at the official king lists of Babylon, Belshazzar was not the last official king of Babylon. The last official king of Babylon was a man named Nabonidus. Nabonidus. He ruled for 17 years. And the tablets are dated from year 1 to year 17 and then the Persian conquest. So who's Belshazzar? His son. His son and the crown prince. But an unusual thing happened. You know, in later times, the people of Babylon said Nabonidus was a madman. But he got into a feud with the priests of Marduk. And so he left. He left the city of Babylon. He left his capital city. And he left for 10 years. And he went out and lived at an oasis in Tema in Arabia. It actually was a big city. And it controlled the trade routes through Arabia, so he had good reason to go to that particular place. If the king leaves the capital, what are you going to do with the kingship? And the answer is, you've got to give it to somebody. So what he did, he gave it to his son. Now, Belshazzar is a very obscure person. Outside of the book of Daniel, until the year 1880, he was unknown. Unknown. You see, what happens is, some big and famous figures, the stories about them are passed down, you know, to the Greek and Roman historians and later on and so forth. And that Nabonidus was known. There were stories about Nabonidus. But there were no stories about Belshazzar. You know, we have stories about Cyrus from the ancient world. Lots of stories about Cyrus. Lots of stories about Nebuchadnezzar. And these stories survived. So we knew these kings. We did not know Belshazzar. Belshazzar was unknown except in the book of Daniel. Starting about 1880, they began to decipher tablets, business tablets, that mentioned Belshazzar. So his name first began to appear. And as his name appeared, he was identified as the crown prince, the son of Nabonidus. And these discoveries of the name of Belshazzar continued until 1929, and a man named Sidney Smith, working in the British Museum, published a tablet which is called The Verse Account of Nabonidus. And it's the story of how he left the city and went away from the city and how he, quotes, entrusted the kingship to Belshazzar. So Belshazzar is an unusual person in that he is a co-king. We call it co-regent. Co-regent. We have co-regents in the Bible, in Israel. David put Solomon on his throne with him before he died. Did you remember that story, 1 Kings 1? And David says, praise be to God that he's given me a son to sit with me in my throne. Co-regents. And there are other co-regents in the Old Testament. But here we have, in general, the Egyptians used that commonly. There are a lot of co-regents in Egypt. The Babylonians did not use it. This is an unusual arrangement, rare. But Belshazzar and his father Nabonidus ruled as co-regents. And the 10 years that Belshazzar was off in Tema in Arabia, I'm sorry, I got it backwards. Nabonidus is off in Tema in Arabia. Belshazzar is governing the city and country of Babylon. And that's why the dates on Daniel chapter 7 and Daniel chapter 8 says the first year of Belshazzar and the third year of Belshazzar. And so those are dates during that 10-year period when Nabonidus, his father, is away from the kingdom. Now the Persians were threatening. And they were knocking on the gates of the east. And so Nabonidus comes back to the city in the year 540. And they're getting ready for the Persian attack.
And there was a military technique. In fact, I read to you the story of the campaigns of the year 605. And in the year 605, the king stayed at home, but the crown prince took the army out. Or it could be the reverse. The king could take the army out, and the crown prince would stay at home. And so they divided the army. There was a division in Babylon and a division in the field. And the king would take the division in the field, or the crown prince would take the division in the field. And the other one was left behind for the obvious purpose of guarding the throne. Because if everybody left the city and you came back, you just might find somebody sitting on your throne. So the idea is to protect the throne. And that's what they did. So that's the way they... Now then, as the Persians attack, the Persians are crossing the Tigris River to the east. So what are you going to do to defend your country? What happened, according to the tablet known as the Nabonidus Chronicle, is the king, Nabonidus, took a division of the army, went out to the Tigris River, and fought with Cyrus as they crossed the Tigris at a place called Opus. And at Opus on the Tigris, Cyrus's forces defeated the forces of Nabonidus, and Nabonidus fled. Doesn't say where he fled to, he just fled, you know. He's retreating. At the same time, the Persian attack on Babylonia was a two-pronged attack. Cyrus, with his division, met Nabonidus with his division, and Cyrus took a general whose name was Gubaru, who may be Darius the Mede of the Book of Daniel, and Darius the Mede took the other division and went around and encircled the city of Babylon. And so that's where we find this episode in Daniel chapter 5. In fact, the tablet gives us a precise date when the city fell. It says that it happened on the 16th day of the month of Tishri. Now, some of you may have heard that name Tishri, because the month of Tishri is a very important month in the Bible. It's also known as the seventh month of the Israelite calendar. The month of Tishri is the seventh month, and the seventh month has some very important festivals. It has Rosh Hashanah, the fall New Year's, on the first day of the month. It has Yom Kippur, or the Day of Atonement, on the 10th day of the month. And it has the Feast of Tabernacles on the 15th to the 22nd day of that same seventh month, Tishri. Tishri here, Tishri among the Israelites. So it's interesting to see. You know, they give us the Babylonians gave us a specific date, the night the city fell. It's the 16th day of Tishri in the 17th year of Nabonidus. And we have tables, so you can look that up, and it comes out to October 12, 539 B.C. So we have you can write that date at the head of Daniel chapter 5. Fulfilled, occurred, historically took place, October 12, 539 B.C. That's the date on the chapter, even though there is not a date in the text of the chapter. And in fact, the tablet goes on to say that the city fell without a battle. We have three different sources, two Greek historians and the Nabonidus Chronicle, and all three of them agree that the city fell without a battle. Now, the battle took place out in the battlefield at the Tigris River. There was a battle going on, but there wasn't a battle at the fall of Babylon, which took place approximately the same time, just about the same time. Now, that's the setting for when we go into the palace. And you might say, well, Belshazzar was a fool. You know, he's holding this huge big banquet when he knows the Persian army has encircled the city. They're out there. Well, if you look at this wall, this is a triple wall, and this is a triple wall. So you have, if you're an attacking army, you have to get through three walls here, and you have to get through three walls here if you're going to fight your way into the city. They didn't fight their way into the city, as you know the story so well. So the story is about the diversion of the river. And incidentally, in the month of October, the Euphrates River is at its lowest. You see, as the melting snows up in Turkey
fill the Euphrates in the spring and first half of the summer, and then gradually the river goes down, so it's at its lowest ebb. So the amount of work involved would have been much less in October than if you're going to do it in April. And so the Persian army comes down, and they enter by the water gate. See, they had the water gate. We had our water gate scandal, and they had their water gate scandal. So you see, he felt perfectly secure. I got six walls, 20 feet thick, each one of them, 12 to 20 feet, they varied, between me and the Persians. They're never going to get in that wall. But they did get in, and they got in this way. They got in the back door. Now, there were supposed to have been guards at those gates, and that's the interesting story. The prophecy in Isaiah about Cyrus says, I will open before you the two-leaved gates. Now, the common historical view is, since Nabonidus was a much detested ruler, that the guards at the gate just opened the gate and let the Persians in. A fifth column. Traitors. Get rid of this crazy king and we'll get some... Cyrus will give us liberation. In fact, there's a text from Cyrus about his conquest of Babylon. It said all the people praised... It's probably propaganda, but he says all the people praised me and threw olive branches in front of me and so on and so forth when he came into the city, like he was the great deliverer. Now let's go back to the scene in the palace that night before the city falls. Well, they're having this big banquet, and then the handwriting comes on the wall. And the handwriting, let's say an angel or maybe God himself is doing the writing. And so maybe, just maybe, the hand that wrote on the wall of the palace was also the hand that opened the gates by the river. It's a possibility. Maybe it wasn't just disloyal soldiers who wanted to get rid of a mad king. Maybe God directly intervened. He certainly directly intervened in the palace. And so it's the same problem those poor... The poor wise men of Babylon, they don't come off very good in the book of Daniel because they don't seem to be able to solve any of the puzzles. So they're called to interpret the writing and they can't. So the Queen Mother remembers, oh, well, there was a Hebrew captive from a long time ago in Nebuchadnezzar's time. Call him. He may be able to help you. So Daniel comes in and, of course, Daniel interprets it. And he says, your kingdom is... you've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Death sentence. And so the only person who died in the battle for the palace that night was the king. The troops didn't die. There was no battle. But the king died because he was taken prisoner and executed. Now, if we want to look at the accuracy of history... Let's suppose for a moment that you are a writer in Jerusalem in the 2nd century B.C. and you're writing up a story about the fall of Babylon. What king would you know about that you would put in the palace that night in your story? The answer is Nabonidus. He was known. So if you're going to create a story, Nabonidus is the king that you would have known as the last king of Babylon. You would not have had any knowledge of Belshazzar. If you're creating this chapter of the book of Daniel at that time. But that's not what the writer of Daniel does. He picks a king who is unknown. In the 2nd century B.C., he was unknown. And he says... He's the king who was in the palace the night it fell. And who doesn't he put there? He doesn't put the chief king, the superior regent, because the superior regent is out at the Tigris River fighting a battle. we could easily have caught the writer of the book of Daniel in a mistake. All he had to do was put Nabonidus in the palace that night. And we say, look, we have Babylonian texts who show us who was where, and this is wrong. That's not what he did. He knows that Nabonidus, the chief king, is not in the palace that night, or he would have attended the banquet. Why isn't he at the banquet? Because he wasn't in the city. Where is he? He's out at the Tigris River fighting a battle. So who goes to the banquet? Who calls the banquet? Belshazzar, the obscure king that nobody in the second century BC would have known anything about. So the book of Daniel shows that. How did Daniel know that? Because he was an eyewitness. Only an eyewitness in the palace that night in the 6th century BC on October 12, 539 BC could have known that. Or somebody who lived right around that time in the next few months, weeks, months, or years. Somebody in the 2nd century BC would never have known that. So you can apply a historical test to Daniel chapter 5, and Daniel chapter 5 comes through with flying colors. No historian, no literary creator in the 2nd century BC could have done that. Impossible. Sources were not available to him to know that. Only an eyewitness in the palace that night could have known it. So you see, we have a general information supporting the accuracy of this chapter because we know of how Belshazzar came to be a co-regent. And we have specific, detailed information about what happened that very night in the palace. Now, when the Persians take over, there's this obscure king called Darius the Mede. And there is much discussion about who he is, and I have spilt entirely too much ink on that problem. And I don't know. My guess is that it probably was Gubaru, the general for Cyrus who conquered Babylon, and that he ruled Babylon for Cyrus. Cyrus was the emperor of the Persian Empire, and Darius was the vassal king underneath him who ruled the province of Babylon. But other suggestions have been made. Some people say it's Cyrus himself. Depends on how you translate the last verse in Daniel chapter 6. So we have these different possibilities. And the problem that Daniel gets involved in is what we call professional jealousy. Professional jealousy. Well, if you've worked in an office or a company, you may have run into professional jealousy. Somebody doesn't like you because you're higher up the ladder or because you've got something, a promotion above them. Professional jealousy. So all of the officials of the new government of Babylon, and most of them were Babylonians who were selected, they're promoted into the Persian government, but they want to get rid of Daniel. So they set the plot, and you know the plot. The plot is nobody can pray to anybody but the king for 30 days. And you may say, that's a very strange story. Incidentally, the gods of Babylon, the gods of Babylonia, the sitters of Babylonia were brought into the city of Babylon during the Persian siege. The gods were supposed to defend the city. Of course, they didn't do a very good job of it, so that shows how impotent those Babylonian gods were. So that may be the setting for this unusual request. Well, anyway, Daniel continues, you know, three times a day. He's at it. He's on his knees. And he doesn't even bother to pull the curtains. And so they didn't have to wait 30 days. They caught him on the first or second day. Well, you know, the old story goes, if you were indicted for being a Christian, how much evidence would there be against you? How would you fare up under the decree against Daniel? Would you be convicted or like he was, or would you go scot-free? Well, you can answer that question yourself. But anyway, he's thrown down in the lion's den. Incidentally, we have tablets which tell about the rations given to the animals in the royal zoo. And the hanging gardens of Babylon were located right here in this corner of the palace. And probably, we don't know this for certain, but probably the zoo was located immediately adjacent, either here or here.
So the Royal Zoo had lions in it, and Daniel was cast down into their den, but he survived. And then Darius chose him to be one of the three presidents because he could see what a qualified man of character this Daniel was. And so the king is anxious. He can't sleep all night long. So he goes the next morning and says, "Oh, Daniel, does your God whom you serve, has he delivered you?" And Daniel says, "O king, my God has sent his angels who has shut the mouths of the lions." I'll conclude with a story, a modern story of this. I didn't meet the person involved, but I met the editor who wrote up the story. And the story comes from Recife, Brazil. I was teaching in Brazil several times, and I heard this story on one of my trips down there. In the city of Recife, there's this public zoo. And there was a young man working in that zoo who took Bible studies from the Adventists and eventually was baptized in the Adventist church. And so Monday morning after his baptism, he comes to work. And he's thrilled. He's really charged up. And he says, "A wonderful thing happened to me Saturday." And so his fellow workers say, "Oh, what's that?" "I was baptized in the Seventh-day Adventist church." And one particularly cynical and sarcastic fellow worker says to him, "Oh, yeah? Well, if you're such a great hero of the faith, why don't you jump down here in this cage with these lions?" Now, there is such a thing as presumption. But sometimes the Lord has people do very strange things. And on this particular occasion, without a moment's hesitation, he jumped down in the cage with the lions. And those lions, like Daniel's lions, hadn't been fed for 24 hours. And so one of the big male lions with the big rough mane around his neck, he notices a movement over there, and he's laying out there sleeping. And so he sees this movement, and so he walks over, and he comes up to the man who's standing there, and he sniffs his pant leg. And then he turns around and he walks back and he flops down and goes to sleep again. Now, you may ask, why would God stimulate that man to do that action at that time? And the answer is in the sequel to the story. Because seven of his fellow workers in that zoo were eventually baptized in the Adventist church as a result of his witness. And Daniel had his convert too, because Darius the Mede gives a paean of praise at the end of the story, praising the God of Daniel. Well, we need to praise the God of Daniel now, and we should dismiss with prayer. So let's stand. Our loving Heavenly Father, we thank you for the faithful witness of Daniel's three friends, that they could stand firm against the image that was set up, even though the rest of the world bowed down. We pray that when the test comes upon us in this country and around the world, that we too may stand faithful and firm like they did. We thank you for Daniel's courage and his faith, which shut the mouths of lions. We pray, dear Lord, that you will give us that kind of faith. And as we look forward to your soon coming, we thank you for the examples of these faithful ones who have gone on before us. And may we join them soon when you come. For we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International Copyright 2008, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.